Florida's Republican voters say Donald Trump is their pick for president. Just ahead, we've got the full results of UNF's new statewide poll, and it does not have good news for native son Marco Rubio. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher or watch the show video on demand at our new partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls as a new poll out of UNF finds that Donald Trump tops Marco Rubio here in Florida 1 week out from the state's winner-take-all primary. Get on the line now with your thoughts and questions. 549-2937 to join us. Also this morning, celebrating 5 years of the women's leadership event, Generation W. Plus, world-renowned autism experts are in town today for today's 8th Annual Autism Symposium over on the UNF campus. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, a new statewide poll just out today finds that if the Republican primary were held today, Donald Trump would garner 35% of the votes here in Florida. Marco Rubio comes in second in UNF's new statewide poll at 28%. Ted Cruz and John Kasich trail that field. And there's much more to reveal in this new data. Here to share it all with us, pollster Mike Binder. He runs the school's public opinion research lab and joins us now with the full results. Mike, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And what are your questions and thoughts as the new UNF poll finds Donald Trump leading the pack of Republican primary voters less than a week before the state's winner-take-all primary? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. So, Mike, if the primary were held today, you're finding Donald Trump well out in front of Florida Senator Marco Rubio, 35% to 23%. That's a big gap.
Yeah, just over 12, just right around 12 points. That's a big number to overcome in a week, especially the way he's been trending, the way Rubio has performed in several of the last primaries.
Marco Rubio has been saying that he's going to win Florida. There have been calls, we've heard by some, for him to actually drop out of the race before the Florida primary, Mike, because if he loses Florida, people that care about his future prospects think that could permanently kill his political career. What about that? Is Marco Rubio going to make his last stand here in Florida?
I certainly think that for him to have a realistic chance to win this nomination, one of two things has to occur. One, he has to win Florida, or two, Cruz and Kasich have to drop out very, very quickly. And based on what Cruz has been doing in the primaries, I don't see that happening.
No, Ted Cruz is even opening up campaign offices here in Florida as a way to sort of cut Marco Rubio off at the pass.
Yeah, and this is an interesting gamble by Cruz, right? With Trump as the front runner, he's trying to let Rubio lose Florida in hopes of pushing him out so that he could potentially woo his supporters down the road.
And there's more data that you found when you polled the state's Republican likely primary voters. What else stands out in this new poll?
I think, well, the one thing people are talking about is what happens when people drop out? Where do these folks go? So who are these candidates' second choice? And interestingly, the vast majority of Rubio's second choice are Cruz. And then vice versa for Cruz, the majority of Cruz supporters, their second choice tends to be Rubio. And some of the pundits have been talking about Kasich, how if he loses Ohio, if he drops out, that support would automatically go to Rubio. That's not the case here in Florida. In fact, Kasich supporters are evenly split across all three candidates.
Interesting. And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with UNF pollster Mike Binder as a new statewide poll out of the university finds that Donald Trump far tops Marco Rubio among likely Republican primary voters in Florida less than a week before the state's winner-take-all primary, seen as key to Rubio's hopes of gaining the Republican nomination for president. If you have a question or a comment, we want your calls right now. Give us a call at 549-2937. And then you also asked that if the general election were held today and the matchup was between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, not surprisingly, 74% of likely Republican primary voters say they'd go for Trump, but nearly 8% of them said they would choose Clinton, and nearly 10% said they would not vote at all.
which is really saying something. For somebody to show up in a primary in this weird March of a year and then say, hey, I'm not going to turn out to vote and I'm not going to vote for president in November if Trump is the guy, that's really a strong statement and an indictment against him as a potential candidate.
Establishment Republicans have mounted a scorched earth campaign in Florida to stop Donald Trump from gaining Florida's 99 delegates on the Republican side. There are radio ads, digital ads, spokespersons making speeches. Mitt Romney gave a speech the other day. Is that going to make a difference or is it going to backfire?
I don't know that much of all that matters. The problem is not, you're not going to turn Trump supporters off. They are Trump supporters. They're ardent and they're excited and they're not looking to go for Rubio or Cruz. The problem is there's Rubio, there's Cruz, and there's Kasich, and they're dividing that rest of the vote. That right. other 60% is getting divided. I'm not saying that it's a clear 60-40 split. If everybody drops out, the other person's going to win. I think it'll be close. But as long as you have that math and there's those other three candidates, they're going to divide the vote, and Trump is going to cruise to victory.
Now, let's talk about Marco Rubio's strategy then for Florida. He is getting strong support in South Florida, particularly among that influential Cuban community from which he hails. Less support, though, from Hispanics across the state generally. Can Marco Rubio garner enough turnout in South Florida's Cuban community and up here in North Florida, where he thinks he has a base, to overcome Donald Trump?
And that's really interesting. The short answer is no. But I think what's fascinating about that is people typically talk about voting blocks and they think the Hispanic vote is monolithic. And it is not.
Not at all.
Not at all. And the Cuban vote is different than the Puerto Rican vote. And it's different than the Central American and the South American vote. And obviously, Rubio is doing great amongst Cubans. He's a Cuban. He hails from South Florida. It makes a lot of sense. He would need essentially 90% turnout amongst that Cuban population. I don't see that as likely to occur,
yeah.
Although he's making a big push. So I think it's unlikely that will happen.
And what about North Florida? Is North Florida going to go for Donald Trump?
I think probably, but I think it'll mirror most of the rest of the state where you have Trump winning this plurality in the, you know, the high 30s, something around that range.
Now, this poll spoke only with Republican primary voters.
But Republicans.
Let's talk about the primary for the Democratic side where Hillary Clinton, the latest polls we have show her handily winning Florida.
Yeah, we came out with our poll for the Democrats last week, and she's up huge. She's up 30 points over Bernie Sanders. And I think a lot of that has to do with a little bit of the demographic makeup here in Florida. It doesn't bode well for Bernie.
And if Hillary Clinton takes Florida's delegates on March 15th, is Bernie Sanders out of the race?
I think Bernie Sanders, even though he won Michigan last night, and that's a nice piece for him, the demographics of the Democratic primary don't bode well for him. He struggles in the African-American community, and that's a huge block in a lot of states. He has problems with older folks that are retired. He has problems in different areas, and that's a big chunk of the Democratic Party. I think it's an uphill fight for him, and I think most people believe that Hillary, while locked in a tough battle, is ultimately going to prevail.
And as we speak with UNF pollster Mike Binder about the Florida primary coming up next week, new polling shows that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are poised to win handily here in the Sunshine State. What are your thoughts about that? It's 549-2937 to join us. Douglas in Jacksonville. Hi, Douglas. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't really have any opinion on the political candidates or the political issues. I'm more interested in how the data is collected for these polls now, because I know that the majority of my friends have essentially given up their home telephone. And also with caller ID, they're not going to answer calls that they don't recognize. So are these polls actually reliable?
Thanks for that. Let's talk about how you gathered this data and what about his concern that maybe it's not quite accurate?
That's a great question. And this is very important to understand. Our data were pulled from, in this case, the voter files. And folks that have phone numbers attached to that. Approximately 40% of these calls were completed on a cell phone. Typically, when we do other surveys, we tend to do a higher proportion of cell phones. But the likely voter group for the Republican primary tends to be much older.
They have more landlines.
But that's certainly an important understanding. And yes, I know every time I talk to somebody and say I'm doing polling, they're like, oh, I don't answer my phone. So therefore, nobody answers their phone. And therefore, all these polls are nonsense. And I think that the answer is because we're using live callers, because we're calling with a 904 number, we leave a message the first time that we don't talk to these folks so they know what's happening. Mm-hmm. We do get good response rates. And in fact, we had great response rates for this poll. I mean, we average less than 15 dials per complete. And that includes if we dial people back more than once. So I think they're reliable. Certainly, we have a lot of don't knows and no answers, so there's mm-hmm. going to be some movement. And I'm mm-hmm. not going to say that these are absolutely going to be the results next week. Things can change. But in general, I'm a believer of these as catching trends.
And of course, a primary poll is very different from a general election poll. You'll have a younger, more diverse audience, and they will be much more likely to not have a landline.
Absolutely.
And that will that affect the way you poll in the fall?
Certainly. We're going to have a different sampling frame. We're going to be going out for a different variety of people, especially when you're thinking general election. There's no nonpartisan affiliates in this sample. So absolutely, depending upon what the question you're asking, it absolutely alters the frame of the sample.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, as UNF's new poll finds Donald Trump far outstripping Marco Rubio in Florida among Republican primary voters less than a week before Florida's critical March 15th winner-take-all primary. Let's go back to the phones. Cameron in St. Augustine. Hi, Cameron. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me. How are you doing today?
Sure, we're doing great. Thanks.
Good, good. I just had a question. I'm a young voter in Florida. I'm 25, and I was just kind of curious as to, you know, Barack Obama had a very huge younger voting base, so a lot of the younger kids gave him a lot of support, and I'm not quite seeing as much of that with Hillary. In fact, almost more for Bernie when it comes to people I talk to that are my age. So I'm wondering if that's going to be a huge effect on Hillary and maybe even the fact of the Democrats winning the election is that she doesn't have the pull to get the younger generation out to vote for her quite the same that a Barack Obama did. And I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Thanks, Cameron. Thanks for that.
You're two for two on callers this morning. These are two great
good questions,
right?
Yeah.
Your caller is absolutely right. Hillary is not connecting with young voters, and that's going to be a problem for the Democrats. Now,
those Bernie Sanders voters go to Hillary if and when he drops out?
Assuming that Bernie Sanders does the right thing and endorses Hillary Clinton after he loses this race, that's great. However, will that enthusiasm be there? Will she be able to translate that? I'm skeptical. But once you see who the alternative is on the Republican side, suddenly maybe some more of those voters might be a little more engaged. It's going to be difficult to see, but I doubt that she's going to engender the type of enthusiasm Obama did in 08 and 12.
And will Bernie Sanders actively campaign for her and encourage his passionate voter base to support her?
I would suspect yes, based on their relationship going into this.
More collegial than on the Republican side.
Even though it's trending a little more aggressive lately, I would expect that all those wounds will be healed and he'll be out. She'll have Clinton out. She'll have another. Obama will be out, presumably in force. So I think they'll make an effort at it. I just don't know if it's going to be there.
And if, as expected, she taps Texas rising star Julian Castro as her VP...
It's much too early to start speculating on VPs, but certainly you would expect either of these candidates to kind of dip into the demographic pools a little bit differently.
Yeah. Will she pick a Latino? Will Donald Trump maybe pick a female vice presidential pick?
Who knows? I'm not convinced Donald Trump's going to be the nominee yet.
Yeah, you're still not convinced
of that. I'm not convinced.
Who do you think will be?
Ultimately, at this point, if I had to put money on, I think Cruz has a really good chance.
You think he's going to wrest this away from Donald Trump?
I do, because as if Kasich loses Ohio, and I think he will, and if Rubio loses Florida, and based on our data, it looks like he will.
It comes down to those two guys.
It looks like Kasich drops out, and then does Rubio drop out? And then if it's Cruz and Rubio that have to decide, and Rubio goes, and it's just Cruz versus Trump, you know, I think there's a really good chance Cruz can start winning some of these states with the other support. Donald Trump's opposition is strong. They might not love Ted Cruz, but they might dislike Trump more.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. Autumn in Riverside. Hi, Autumn. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi there. Good morning. I just want to make a point about polling that, for instance, the Michigan, Bernie Sanders won that last night, not by an extreme margin, but he's been polling much, much lower than Hillary Clinton. So I just want to say, you know, make sure and get out and vote, everybody, because if your preferred candidate, even if they're polling low, especially if they're polling low, you should go and vote for who you want, because it worked in Michigan. So
yeah, thanks,
I just
Autumn.
I wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Autumn. Yes, Hillary Clinton was leading polls in Michigan, didn't win the state.
Very true. And there's two pieces to this. One is these polls are conducted days in advance and things happened. Bernie had a great debate performance in Flint the other night. The other piece of this is who is in that sampling frame and how is that calculated? And if there's a big turnout of younger voters, people that might be unlikely or unexpected to turn out, if they can come in, they often don't find themselves caught up in these polls. And that's an opportunity to overperform.
And here's an email from Christopher referring to Marco Rubio's last stand here in the state. He writes, Rubio won his Senate seat only because the Democratic vote was split. He is not popular in Florida. Do you agree with that?
His job approval ratings, when we've been polling, have always been above 50%. Is he beloved in Florida? No, but very few people actually are because the state is so diverse and very different. We are a purple state. We go back and forth in presidential elections, even though the legislature is heavily Republican. And I think because we have such diversity and differences between the South and the North, it's difficult to find that hometown politician that everybody loves.
And let's go now to Bill in Mandarin. Hey, Bill, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, say that I'm glad to see that people begin to realize that the term conservative and Republican are exclusive terms. I will say this, if this thing runs into a brokered convention and Trump does not get a fair shake, this Republican is voting for the Democrat. Thanks.
And that's, there's been a lot of talk. I'm still not convinced we're headed for a brokered convention.
Really?
Because
what
there's
about
so
what he said?
Well, he's certainly true, yeah. Right? Folks that are supportive of Trump and feel that the party is out to screw them are absolutely angry and fearful. The question is, what happens if Cruz wins straight up? What happens to those Trump voters? Do they come back? Do they just step away? Do they vote for Hillary? There's a lot of Republicans that
do you think
Trump
some Republicans will vote for Hillary Clinton
absolutely.
Over Trump?
Absolutely.
If she's the nominee.
Absolutely.
What if Bernie Sanders would be the nominee?
Bernie Sanders actually has higher favorables amongst Republicans than Hillary Clinton
in
does.
The national polling shows Bernie Sanders would beat Donald Trump in a general election by a wider margin than Hillary Clinton, although that's an early poll, of course.
Right. It's an early poll, and there's a lot to happen between now and then.
And speaking of that, here's a tweet from a listener. Why are you saying Ted Cruz has a shot, but Bernie should drop out?
I think the math is a little bit different because it's down to Clinton and Bernie, and Clinton is really pulling away. She's halfway there. The states that she's winning convincingly. He's barely eking out close victories. I'm not saying Bernie should drop out. I just don't think he has the wherewithal, the campaign, and the connection with enough of the Democratic primary voters to ultimately win this race.
But because you're saying he can't make up the delegate math.
It's not just the delegate math. It's winning states, too. So
he can't win enough states.
He can't win enough states, and he can't make up the delegates. It's all of that.
But you don't think Ted Cruz can?
I absolutely think Ted Cruz can, because if you take out Rubio and you take out Kasich, where do those voters go? In Florida, the poll that we did, most of Rubio's supporters are going to Cruz. Kasich's a little more split, but I think suddenly you go to a very close race, and I think it would be interesting to see.
Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, good morning. I'm a libertarian supporter, Gary Johnson in particular, and I'm curious what you guys would think about maybe Bernie's supporters switching to him if it is Hillary on the ticket, or even if Republicans are not happy with Trump.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Well, is that likely given that everything Bernie Sanders is advocating is pretty much the opposite of what most libertarians believe?
Basically, that's
but
true.
But could some vote for
it? Aside from maybe some social policies like same-sex marriage and abortion and things like that, I can't envision very many Bernie supporters going to a Gary Johnson or a libertarian of any sort.
But he indicated he might be open to that.
Sure. I think once people... So what's interesting, this primary has been very personality driven.
Yeah, people are responding to a persona.
Right.
And a message.
Right. And part of that is Donald Trump. And part of that is an inability of Washington to actually do policy. So people are skeptical that any policy is getting done. I think once the general comes around, you're going to start to see much more policy discussion because there's going to be divergence between the Democrats and Republicans. And I think it'll kind of retreat to a more conventional type of election.
And of course, you'll be back talking about it later in the year. But for today, UNF's new poll finds Donald Trump far out in front of Marco Rubio in Florida among Republican primary voters. Less than a week to go until the Florida primary. Pollster Mike Binder, always great to see you, and thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Much more still ahead later. Important new research for parents and caregivers with kids on the autism spectrum. But up next, celebrating a milestone, Generation W, marking 5 years in the city of promoting women in leadership. That's next.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, pressure mounts for both Republican and Democratic presidential hopefuls, primary results from Michigan and Mississippi, plus Republican contests in Idaho and Hawaii, the latest on the race for delegates.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. The bidding begins March 10th and continues through March 21st. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, it is quite a milestone this year for Generation W. The landmark Women's Leadership Conference here on the First Coast is celebrating 5 years of promoting leadership and community for women. We're pleased to welcome founder Donna Orender and Baptist Health Senior Vice President Audrey Moran here now to give us a preview of this year's big event. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And congratulations, Donna Orender. You started this 5 years ago. What an incredible journey it's been.
Well, I like to say we created it, right? This is really about we. It's about community. And it is an incredible journey. And the best part of it is we get to write new chapters all year long. And so, you know, there is a culminating chapter, but then it keeps going. So we're looking forward to April 8th and to have one of our great, 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 incredible thinkers, leaders here, Audrey Moran, who has been such a great supporter and engager in this, is incredibly an honor.
Now, Audrey, this is coming up on April 8th on the UNF campus. Some incredible speakers are going to be on hand. This is exciting.
You know, it really is exciting. And I can remember vividly sitting down with Donna 6 years ago, and she was saying, what if we became known, we, our community, became known as thought leaders around the country?
That's exciting stuff. And what she has built with a fabulous team of women from around the country, I think puts us in a position of thought leadership. People are talking about Gen W all year long, looking forward to it all year long. And I think what's really maybe most exciting is the conversations that it spawned around our community about women in leadership. I'm going to three of them this week.
That's
wow.
Right. We are busy. We are busy. Used to be I'd have to have Audrey come here just so I can see her, but now I get to see her so much more.
Let me just say, I can't believe we actually got you both here at the same time. These are two of the most busy women I know, and that's a testament to their leadership. You're very much in demand. You also have brought, or you're bringing in some incredible speakers this year.
We really are. And it's interesting because I know that you have Lieutenant General coming in right now. I just left Terry West, who is chairing JAX USA's military committee. And we really want to dig in. We started about a year ago thinking about women and the military. And who knew that this was going to be an area that has had so much change and so much conversation before Defense Secretary Ash Carter came in and said women are going to be, you know, part of the front lines. They're going to be in the front line of battle. Jacksonville, in particular, as the third largest city, I believe, for veterans. We are a proud military community. It is a national and global issue, and we have incredible leadership here. We have Admiral Jackson, who is, you know, head of the Navy Southeast, oversees 18, I think, Navy installation bases, a $7.5 billion budget. Mm-hmm. So he'll be joined by Lee Bradley, who's from the Department of Defense and Veteran Affairs. He'll be joined by Admiral Evans, who will be the moderator. General Bob Brown will be coming from the Army. And then we have Chief, these titles sometimes confound me, but enlisted Beldo, who will be joining us as well. So I think that'll be a great conversation. One thing I do want to say is that it's not enough for us to talk about these things. We will be educated, we'll be inspired, we will be connected, but we're going to now be moved to action.
And that's the key. And Audrey, you've been part of a movement called 9 in 15, trying to get more women elected to local office. That's one way of going from inspiring talk to making a difference with actions.
You know, the activation piece is so important. And I think what you see from groups like 9 in 15 is they understand the collective power of women, that when smart, passionate women get together, the world can change. And we want men to be part of it, too. At the end of the day, it's not just activating women. It's also activating men to understand that when women's voices are at the table, we make better decisions. We're stronger as a community. We're stronger in business. You know, all the studies show that women on boards make for more profitable companies. And it's that diversity is strength theme that I think women really get.
Yeah, women on boards and women in senior leadership positions. There is data to support that.
Tremendous amount of data. And let's look at another fact that's really important. And I'm sitting here with our incredible chairman of our chamber. And within the next 20 years, we will have a labor shortage. 29 million people would be the gap in terms of needed labor in the United States. Where is that going to come from? If we don't look to our own, if we don't really look to be able to create parity and opportunity for like over 50% of our citizens, right? So women have a vital role to play, and women and men together, actually, I know this is going to sound a little interesting, I hope it does, but they liberate each other, right? When things are better for women, they're also better for men, and I can't emphasize that enough. And we'll have an author coming, actually. I have her book here, J. Newton Small, who actually talks about broad influence. And it's really about the tipping point in industries that when you get to a certain percentage, how much better the workforce is and the productivity.
Yeah, and that broad influence, how women are changing the way America works, written by a guy.
No, it's a woman.
Oh, Jay is a woman.
Jay is
oh,
a young
sorry.
Woman. Okay. That's what we love. And actually, Audrey's going to do a follow-up on this with Jay at Generation W, where we're going to be revealing some interesting research, we think.
And do you feel that men are getting this message?
You know, I think they are. I think especially men who are coming up into the ranks of leadership right now. It's like all diversity in the generation of my children who are young professionals in the workforce. Diversity is just a given. They understand the power mm-hmm. of diversity. They understand the power of different voices. And it is an absolute given in their way of life. So I'm really hopeful for our community and our workforce as we really look at the power of all types of diversity, but Gen W is the voice for women.
Well, the website to get your tickets and to learn more about Generation W is genwnow.com. genwnow.com. Not too late for people to register and mark their calendar.
We would encourage that highly. All of our events this year have actually been oversubscribed early. But if people want some of the great women in this community, if they want a warm-up session on the 16th, right, next Thursday, Audrey's going to be moderating a panel. We both are very proud of our engagement and membership with the Women's Giving Alliance here. So, Audrey, I don't know if you wanted to mention a little something about that.
Absolutely. That's going to be a great event. Go on the Women's Giving Alliance or the Community Foundation website to learn more. Great panel of powerful women, including Dawn Orender, and we're going to have a really terrific discussion.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. So things are moving. There's a lot of great momentum. And April 8th, we'll be back probably to talk a little bit more about some of our content, which we're really excited about. The speakers are going to be here. It's nice when people call us. As Audrey said, people are now calling us to want to come here and participate.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yes, it's great.
So it's Reputation Grows, Generation W's fifth year on the First Coast, coming up April 8th on the UNF campus. Get your tickets now. Go to genwnow.com. Founder Dawn Orender, Jack's Chamber President and Baptist Health, Senior Vice President Audrey Moran, both with us. And thanks so much for being here.
Melissa, we love being with you.
Thanks, Melissa.
And much more still ahead. We're back in a moment.
For everyone creating their own life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. Sponsored in part by AARP Real Possibilities.
WJCT and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT TV and radio. Submit now through April 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Relax Radio WJCT 89.9 HD3 is your music station, playing the songs you remember best from the Beatles, Elvis, Frank Sinatra, Barbra Streisand, and Motown, 24 hours a day, only on WJCT 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Welcome back. Well, Iran reportedly test-fired two ballistic missiles Wednesday. Written on them in Hebrew, the phrase, "Israel must be wiped out." It's seen as a show of force by the Islamic Republic as U.S. Vice President Joe Biden visited Israel. The World Affairs Council of Jacksonville recently was pleased to put forth Ambassador Marilyn McAfee and Buster Hagenbeck, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General and former superintendent of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. They gave a talk in Jacksonville just the other day about what's going on in Iran. And they join us now with their thoughts. Marilyn, Buster, so good to see you both. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
And as we speak with Ambassador McAfee and retired Lieutenant General Hagenbeck, what are your questions about Iran? It's 549-2937 to join us. Marilyn McAfee, the firing of these missiles isn't a first for Iran, correct?
No, it's not. I think people are confused because they think they've violated an agreement. But they were not a part of the nuclear talks. They were deliberately kept separate. There were parallel talks about weapons, armaments, and ballistic missiles.
And this comes on the heels of this landmark nuclear deal that was just signed with Iran. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it was kept separate because there would have probably been a reduction in the terms of the nuclear negotiations, diminishment. But they have not on that level and those that area of weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear armed missiles, that has not reached an agreement. There is a UN ban on nuclear-armed ICBM missiles, but Iran keeps saying, well, no, that's not ICBM distance yet. I mean, technically, they are correct within the terms of the agreement with the UN designation.
Right. And Buster, go ahead.
And I was just going to say they also respond by saying that those particular missiles cannot carry nuclear arms.
Well, this also comes on the heels of a recent election in Iran where moderates were seen as gaining some more influence. Can you paint a picture for us of how all these different factions are competing for position and what that means geopolitically?
Well, if I could just talk in the big picture for a minute or two, and I'll defer to Marilyn, the expert on the internal politics of Iran. But we know that region has been disrupted for thousands of years, actually, going back to the Persian empires and the conflicts with the Arabs as well as Western European nations. An area of where 360 million Muslims live, and so there's a lot of things that go on that the Shia, Sunni divide, Kurds versus Turks, just a variety of things that cause Iran to be in the middle of a very bad neighborhood.
Marilyn McAfee.
The report of the outcome of the election is very important. It's a question of hardliners versus reformers, liberals. All of that, however, is on a continuum of the theocratic government. So when you're speaking of a reformer or a liberal, that's within the framework of the existing system. However, President Rouhani is deemed in that continuum to be a liberal or a moderate. And his group did win all 30 seats for the parliament from Tehran. Now, Tehran should have had many more seats, but that's a way of moving the power out of Tehran, where more moderate or opposition to the regime would exist. It's the more sophisticated of the cities and the larger of in population. So President Rouhani was strengthened. In fact, he would have been totally debilitated if the nuclear agreement had not gone through. But having been able to achieve that, or in Iranian terms, to achieve a cancellation of the restrictions that they were under, the economic sanctions, that was the major success. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they're not out of the economic woods yet, because the price of oil has dropped so drastically. But yes, it was strengthening the more moderate parts of this regime. The hardliners are still there, and they are the ones who are leading this aggression. They also have control of all of the armaments and the weapons. There are actually two. There is the army, and then there is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. Mm-hmm. And the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is directly responsible to Khamenei and to General Soleimani.
Let me quote from a recent editorial, this week in USA Today. Don't buy the hype about a win in the recent Iranian elections by moderate President Rouhani. As former Undersecretary of State Wendy Sherman, who negotiated the Iran nuclear agreement on behalf of the Obama administration, recently put it, Rouhani is not a moderate. He is a hardliner. Real moderates were barred from running. Buster, do you agree? And how worrisome are these trends for Western nations, in your view?
Well, I agree with her statements, but also I think those trends. I think one of the good things about it, I mentioned demographics, but Iran has the second largest population behind Egypt in the region there. Depending on which country you're in, anywhere from 2/3 to 75% of the folks that live there are 34 years or younger, and they have a very different worldview and regional view, and I think there's some hope for the future because of that.
Do you agree, Ambassador McAfee, can this large, young generation of Iranians who wants a more open society, will they eventually win the day?
Well, I think they will be listened to more by a President Rouhani, the supposed moderates, again, take that in context, and the hardliners are still in power and in control, and they are able to lead a very evil and aggressive side to that government. Many of the young people, the young thinkers, intellectuals, student leaders, they were all arrested, imprisoned. Mm-hmm. Some of them were executed. Many of them were executed. And that is still the procedure because the evil part of this, the General Soleimani, Iranian Republican Guard part of this, controls the judiciary and the Ministry of the Interior. So they can arrest anyone they want and they can sentence anyone they want.
Do you think the nuclear deal was a good deal or was it a mistake given these recent events?
I think it was a good start, but we have to be very careful and keep our eye on the ball and also partner with our UN friends as we can to make sure that they adhere to the policies and regulations in that.
And in the context of a presidential election, what are your thoughts about whichever party gains the White House, how they will deal with Iran?
Well, I think we have a lot of questions about some of the candidates on how they would handle a situation like that. Some are talking more hardball than others. So I think we'll just have to wait and see. But one thing I can say is that Iran, no matter whether it's the evil part of that government or the more moderate part of the government that wants relations with the rest of the world, they are not going to back off of having the kind of power that will ensure that they are never victimized by any other country again. They have been victimized by Western imperialism, as it were, starting back, well, post-World War One was the great beginning, and then it went on from there. They're not going to allow that to happen
again. I agree. We're not going to return to the status quo, and we're not going to put Syria back together, or any Iraq is not going to go back together, and we have to work together with our allies in the region to figure out the way ahead.
Well, she is retired Ambassador Marilyn McAfee and retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Buster Hagenbeck. We're so pleased to have them here in our community. You recently gave a talk about this at the Downtown Rotary Club, both affiliated with the World Affairs Council of Jacksonville. It's always great to speak with both of you and gain your tremendous insights. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
And up next, world-renowned experts on autism are in town for a conference. It's one parents and caregivers need to know about. We'll tell you all about it next.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet,
and who doesn't,
we're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Hey, I'm Al Letson, and I have a new show coming on WJCT called Thing. Not everything, Thing. Come on, say it with me, Thing, because I'm going to do Thing I want to do. Tune in Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, Wolfson Children's Hospital is holding its 8th annual Autism Symposium today on the UNF campus with vital information for parents, educators, and caregivers. This has become quite an annual tradition in town. Here with more, we welcome Jackie Bargas, Program Coordinator. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And two of the symposium speakers, Dr. Catherine Rice, developmental psychologist at Emory University in Atlanta.
Good morning.
Good morning. And also with us, Dr. Nathan Call. He's director of the Severe Behavior Program at Marcus Autism Center in Atlanta. Good to see you.
Morning.
And in a moment, we'll get to our two speakers. But first, Jackie, Wolfson has been putting this symposium on for 8 years, a testament to the need in the community for people to know more about autism.
Yeah, it's actually Wolfson Children's Hospital, Nemours Children's Specialty Care, and UF Health with support from Baptist Health. And we're so appreciative of their involvement with us. And yes, it's our 8th year, and we bring in internationally and nationally known speakers who come and speak on the subject of autism.
And let's talk to them now. Dr. Rice, it's my understanding you were part of the research to help diagnose autism earlier, more consistently, and that actually led to the change in statistics for diagnosing children. It's now 1 in 68 children. You were instrumental in that, correct?
I was a big part of a large effort to determine how many children have autism. It's very complex to really count, particularly when we're seeing so many changes over time in the last 20 to 30 years. The way we see and identify and then subsequently count autism has changed dramatically.
And to what do you attribute the increase in the rates of autism? Is it better diagnosis or a combination of factors?
Well, we've had a lot of changes, and a big part of it is identification and really how we see autism, the lens in which we see autism through, conceiving of autism as a spectrum, but knowing that anybody that has an autism spectrum diagnosis these days still has fundamental challenges and needs services and supports. And so we have a great deal of awareness. So we know that's a big part of it.
And Dr. Call, one of those therapies that many parents here on the First Coast know about is what's known as ABA therapy, Applied Behavioral Analysis. Can you talk a little bit about how that has had success with children?
Sure. So Applied Behavior Analysis stems from behavior analysis, which is just a scientific approach to the study of behavior-environment relationships. And the applied behavior analytic part of that is trying to use that science to accomplish social benefit for people. In the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of research that showed that this approach to trying to produce behavior change in individuals with autism and other developmental disabilities had a lot of success. And that really has driven a push for access, more and more people being able to get access to those services and those providers to work with families and children and other individuals to produce the kinds of behavior changes that can really make a difference for, for the individual and their family.
And in fact, you get into this at the Marcus Severe Problem Behavior Program, correct?
That's right. So we see families and individuals who are exhibiting some kind of behavior that's putting themselves or their caregivers at risk. It's having a huge impact on just the quality of life for these families. We see kids who are doing harm to themselves, to their families, families who often live in a state of siege where they aren't able to really be out in the community. They're isolated from their community. They aren't able to interact. They aren't able to participate in an education in any meaningful way. And so we use these applied behavior analytic approaches to produce the kinds of changes that really can drive a big difference for them and their whole trajectory from that moment on.
Dr. Rice, that's important to note that autism affects the entire family, whether it's a mildly affected individual or child or a really severely affected one.
Well, definitely. And as Dr. Call mentioned, the behaviors that come out of the potential frustration the person with autism is going through because they can't communicate what they're needing or what they're interested in. And the frustration also comes out in those behaviors. And that's challenging for the entire family when they're trying and having a challenging time communicating with their loved one.
Now, it's my understanding there's controversy surrounding recent screening guidelines or recommendations for diagnosing on the autism spectrum. Can you explain what that entails?
I think the American Academy of Pediatrics has been very clear in terms of their support that all children, every child from birth to three, should get both developmental screening and autism screening, which is basically asking the parents structured questions that have been tested to say, this is going to help us identify kids who need extra support. There was a review by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force that said there's not really enough evidence to say that that screening leads to improved functioning and outcomes. And so there's been a pushback where the American Academy of Pediatrics, most clinicians and researchers have continued to stand by and say there's excellent evidence that that screening does help identify and get kids into services that they need. So it's definitely still an important recommendation to screen.
Jackie Bargas, program coordinator for today's symposium. This gives us just a short window into some incredibly vital information about autism spectrum disorders people will be able to download today, right, on the
Correct.
UNF campus.
And we have handouts.
So this is taking off over at UNF in a very short time.
Yes. And at this point, I would say if anyone would like to come, please just walk in at the University Center on the campus of UNF, and we would be happy to register you. I know we have a packed house. There are over 400 people there right now. So,
but it's not too late for people to stop in.
Absolutely not.
Wow.
We're going to 4:30 today.
Yeah, all-day event.
Yes.
Some incredible speakers, and we've been pleased to welcome these two physicians, world-renowned experts, right here in Jacksonville.
Yes.
So this gives you a sense of what's happening.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you both. Thank you all so much for being with us to tell us all about today's 8th Annual Autism Symposium, starting in just a few minutes on the UNF campus at the University Center. As Jackie said, not too late to just walk up, register, and attend. Jackie Bargas is the program coordinator, Dr. Catherine Rice and Dr. Nathan Call, two of the featured speakers today at this event over at UNF. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. Michelle Corum running the board today for us. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. Make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and we're pleased to have video on demand now every day of the show with our new partner, TVJax.com. You can also catch some of those segments at MetroJacksonville.com. Next on Diane Rehm, pressure mounts for both Republican and Democratic presidential hopefuls. Primary results from Michigan and Mississippi, plus the Republican contest in Idaho and Hawaii. The latest on the race for delegates. That's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.